Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we present a discussion on the career and contribution of Marcus the Valentinian, who died 175 AD in the second century. Marcus was as much a hermetic as he was a Gnostic Christian. The church fathers accused him of being more Pythagorean than Christian. He was the developer of the Soma Sophia system of celestial Greek Kabbalah, which we have decoded and perfected, and for that you can see the Seventh Ray, Book 3, The Green Ray. And according to Kieran Berry, Marcus had an influence on the creation of the later Sefer Yetzirah. Marcus developed some of the basic concepts of what became the Kabbalah. Marcus was a Phoenician. He was influenced by the earlier Samaritan Simon Magus. Like Simon, Marcus had a priestess whom he venerated as an equal. He gave communion with his priestess by his side and turned water into wine at the altar. Now, the early church fathers considered this blasphemous. Marcus's cult spread from the Middle East to southern France in the days before Constantine force reformed Christianity. So, if you want to explore the most ancient origins of what we call the Western tradition, then stay with us and spend an hour with a man who may have been the first Rosicrucian. Now, Marcus is a subject near to my heart because we owe more to this man in Western occultism and modern hermetic practice. We owe more to Marcus than we possibly will ever even realize. In fact, Kieran Berry's book, The Greek Kabbalah, which those of you who are really interested in the subject, if you don't have it, you should. The Greek Kabbalah, Alphabetical Mysticism and Numerology in the Ancient World by Kieran Berry, that's K-I-E-R-E-N-B-A-R-R-Y. This is a marvelous book, and it is primarily derived from the numerical and magical and mystical teachings of Marcus. Now, Kieran Berry has done a wonderful job reconstructing Marcus's Kabbalah, his Greek Kabbalah. Now, of course, as you all probably know, Greek is an inflected language, and this means that the Greek Kabbalah, even though it in many ways preceded the Hebrew Kabbalah, and the Hebrew Kabbalah was very much influenced by it, as Kieran Berry points out. In fact, Kieran Berry comes out and says that Marcus's attributions of the alphabetic letters to the planets and the signs of the zodiac and the elements and all that was a direct presage of the 3rd century Sefer Yetzirah, which we're all familiar with. Now, I want to say about the Greek Kabbalah. The reason why the Greek Kabbalah has fallen out of favor is because Greek is an inflected language, whereas Hebrew is not. Now, that may take a little explaining. What I mean by an inflected language is that every tense, every past tense, present tense, different forms, different possessives, they all have different endings. Whereas in Hebrew, you don't have that sort of thing. So the word, whatever the word is going to be the same regardless of the context in which you use it. Now, I know that's an oversimplification, but then that's essentially it, which means that when you start doing gematria, you start doing numerology and all that, you're much, much, it's much easier and more direct to use Hebrew. But regardless of that, the Greek system very probably preceded the Hebrew. And all of this was emerged out of the matrix of Alexandria a couple centuries before Christ and a couple centuries afterward. Alexandria was the hub of all of this. Although Marcus was a Levantine, a Phoenician, if you will, he probably did spend some time studying in Alexandria. All of the Gnostic scholars virtually did at one time or another. And mentioned that his greatest contribution was the Summa Sophia, which we had, with a little help from Dr. Ed Krupp at the observatory, we managed to fill out Marcus's Summa Sophia from the outline, the basic outline that Irenaeus and Hippolytus gave us. And what the Summa Sophia is literally a Kabbalah of the Zodiac. It's a Kabbalah of the Zodiac, and this is why the 24 letters of the Greek alphabet were absolutely perfect for doing this, because you have 12 signs of the Zodiac, so you have 12 letters that Marcus applied, running, say, east to west, and then that gives you 12 letters for the Northern Hemisphere. And then you go around the way the ox plows, plus Staphron, and you go west to east on the underside with 12 more letters. That gives you your full 24, and then you have all the letters that apply to the whole southern hemisphere. And you can't do that with the Hebrew alphabet because you only have 22 letters. Now, even Gershom Scholem, the great Hebrew scholar, Kabbalah scholar, he admitted that the Hebrew alphabet had a shortcoming in that area. But so you see that Marcus was very, very anxious to apply the letters of the alphabet to the Zodiac, and he also, well, he went way beyond that. He applied the letters to creation, to emanations, to the elements, to the planets, to the vowels, to the when you realize what this man did, and when he did it, you can't escape realizing that here we have one of the fathers of the Kabbalah, whether either Greek Kabbalah or Hebrew Kabbalah, and what we did, based upon Hippolytus's commentary, which is a copy of Irenaeus's commentary, by the way, is we got the basic layout, the letters of the zodiac, the Greek letters, and you know, you really don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that if you have a globe, and they didn't use maps in those days. These globes, pretty much. If you had a celestial globe where the zodiac was in the position of the equator instead of going in a loop as it does, you know, up and around, and if you have a globe that is divided right around the middle, with the zodiac running where the where the moon's track would be ordinarily. The moon, of course, follows the celestial equator pretty much. But if you straighten out and have the zodiac, and then you have the top pole and the bottom pole are the poles of the ecliptic, not the actual magnetic pole, then you can take meridians, and if you're, you know, so inclined, you can take meridians and go up from these signs, each one of them having 30 degrees, and you go all the way up to the pole, and then you just go up there and divide that up and put your longitudinal lines across your meridians and keep going up, and you have, and then you have effectively, Kabbalistically, gridded the entire celestial sphere. Now, this is obviously what Marcus intended to do, but and may have done it. I think he probably really did it, but Arrhenius and Hippolytus, both of them were angry fathers of the early Christian church, of the more conservative version of the Christian church that Constantine forced upon us. And they were intent only on discrediting Marcus. But they went into enough detail discrediting Marcus that Kieran Berry was able to write a whole book reconstructing Marcus's Kabbalah from that, and we were able to reconstruct his Summa Sophia from that. But this is, of course, is kind of an example of one of the most infamous examples of this sort of thing, is that the only thing we know about the Egyptian version of the Exodus we get from the Ptolemaic Egyptian historian Manetho. Now, Manetho was the last, in Ptolemy's time, Manetho was the last Egyptian, educated Egyptian, who could read hieroglyphics, believe it or not. In Ptolemy's Greco-Egyptian world, and they'd been ruled by the Grecos for so long that there were hardly anybody left that could read hieroglyphics, and Manetho was a scholar and you know, the last of the old Egyptian scholars, and he could. So Ptolemy, Ptolemy was a bibliophile, and he wanted to be a bibliophile and an astrologer, and he wanted to collect everything from everybody, and he wanted to have it all translated into Greek. And he wanted to put it in the library. So he commissioned Manetho to write a history of Egypt in 9 volumes. Well, that was a very popular book at the time. In other words, there must have been at least 200 copies of it, at least in existence back then. Every single one of those sets of 9 volumes have been destroyed. And the only record we have of Manetho is his critics who had tried at the time to discredit him, and that's all that has survived. And Josephus, of course, being one. So we get the Egyptian version of the Exodus, which Josephus tries very hard to discredit. And that's an example, the same thing with Marcus. This is an example that we wouldn't be able to. Kieran Berry would not have been able to write his book, and we wouldn't have been able to do what we did with the Summa Sophia if it wasn't for Arrhenius and Hippolytus trying to trash Marcus. And, you know, to give you a little sample of that, I happen to have Hippolytus right here in front of me. He's a crusty old character. I don't know how we ever got him over there, but anyway, so we have Hippolytus here. And before I get into Marcus, though, we had a kind of a joke in the seventh ray, not the green one, we had the red one, about the parrots in Libya. And I'll read you the original of that joke here this is from Hippolytus. And that goes this way. Apsuptus the Libyan inordinately longed to become a god, but when, after repeated intrigues, he altogether failed to accomplish his desire, he nevertheless wished to appear to have become a god, and he did at all events appear, as time wore on, to have in reality become a god. And for the foolish Libyans were accustomed to sacrifice unto him, as to some divine power, supposing that they were yielding credence to a voice that came down from above, from heaven. For, collecting into one and the same cage a great number of birds, parrots, he shut them up, and now there are very many parrots throughout Libya, and very distinctly those who imitate the human voice. Now this man, having for a time nourished the birds, was in the habit of teaching them to say, "Apsuptus is a god!" And after, however, the birds had practiced this for a long period and were accustomed to the utterance of that which he thought, when said, would make it supposed that Apsuptus was a god. And then, opening the habitation of the birds, he let forth his parrots, and each in a different direction, while the birds, however, were on the wing. Their sound went out all over Libya.
Apsuptus is a god!
And the expressions of those reached as far as the Hellenic country. And thus the Libyans, being astonished at the voice of the birds and not perceiving the knavery perpetrated by Apsuptus, held Apsuptus to be a god. Someone, however, the Greeks, by accurate examination, perceiving the trick of the supposed god, by means of those same parrots, not only refuted but also destroyed the boastful and tiresome fellow. Now this Greek, by confining many of the parrots, taught them anew to say, "Apsuptus, having caught us, compelled us to say Apsuptus is a god." But having heard of the recantation of the parrots, the Libyans coming together, all unanimously decided on burning Apsuptus. Poor Apsuptus. Well, we kind of improved on that a little bit. In the seventh ray, and we said that there was this fellow in Libya who trained his parrots to say that he was a god, and then there was another adept who trained his parrots to say that this first fellow was not a god, and then there was a third adept who trained his parrots to say, "Everyone is god!" And that's why today there are no parrots in Libya. Okay, well then back to Hippolytus here. Now, Hippolytus, Arrhenius before him, in fact, he primarily copied Arrhenius, he launched into the Gnostics in order. And this gives us his rather gritty satirical commentary on Simon Magus, which precedes Marcus. And, of course, Simon Magus had quite an influence on Marcus. Now, Simon Magus, as you may remember, was almost contemporary with Jesus. He was probably a young boy when Jesus was preaching. And he later, as you probably remember, he tried to become one of Jesus' followers, but the rest of the apostles kind of didn't want him to, because Simon had a reputation of being a conjurer, a magician, and all that. Not that Jesus wasn't, but Jesus, Jesus was a class act, whereas Simon was kind of a stage magician. So they turned him down, and he went and created his own version of things. But Simon found a courtesan, friend is a nice way of putting it, in a happy house in Tyre, and got her out and brushed her teeth and did her hair and whatever, and declared that she was the fallen thought of God, and this was his priestess, and she was the fallen thought of God, and so Simon and his priestess went out and they preached their magical gospel to people, and of course, as you can probably imagine, this is where Crowley got his idea for the Scarlet Woman, you know, was from Simon and Helen. He named her Helen after Helen of Troy. And now, this had an influence on Marcus, obviously. So Marcus came along, you know, after Simon, I guess, had passed away. But Simon was not just a conjurer. Simon was also quite a writer, and he apparently had a rather sophisticated Gnostic philosophy, and which, and quite frankly, there's one kind of ambiguous passage up here. I won't read it because it's almost incomprehensible, but if you read it over and over and over and over again, you get the idea that Simon is promoting the great I Am theory, that God is in all of us, and wherever God is in all of us, that's the center of the universe. This is something Simon was very much aware of. Of course, Jesus was aware of it too, but almost none of the Christians understand that. So in Irenaeus and Hippolytus's march through the ancient world, they deal with Empedocles and Simon's system of free-flowing emanations, and they go on and on and on, and they finally get to Marcus. And when they finally get to Marcus, they really, really, I'm saying they, because Hippolytus is pretty much a lift from Irenaeus, who was a little bit earlier. And by the time they finally get to Marcus, they are really, really on a roll to try to discredit him. And so what they want to do, in order to discredit him, they want him to first prove that he is a Pythagorean, which they very much want to do. And then they want to prove that he's he's having orgies and doing all this. And for the main reason why they want to prove him that is because Marcus, like Simon, and like so many of these early Christian mystics, didn't think this was an all male thing. He thought that men and women ought to be equally involved, and he, like Simon, thought that the woman was the more spiritual of the two. And so the answer to the way the Christian fathers looked at that was that these people must be having orgies. Oh, yeah. Well, the truth is they probably weren't having that. They might have had a few, but then, you know, they certainly were not anywhere near as lascivious as the Christian fathers made them out to be. I'm going to read here a little bit of what Irenaeus has to say about a little bit of what he has to say about Marcus's practices. Yeah, okay. Here we go. Marcus's account of the birth and the life of our Lord. Here we go. Concerning the creation of this Jesus, he expresses himself thus. The powers emanating from the second triad fashioned Jesus, who appeared on earth, and that the angel Gabriel filled the place of the Logos, and the Holy Spirit, that of the soul, and the power of the highest, that of Anthropos, and the Virgin, that of Ecclesia. And so it was, in Marcus's system, that the man who appeared in accordance with the dispensation was born through Mary. And when he came to the water, he says, that he descended like a dove unto him who ascended above and filled the 12th number. And in him resides the seed of these, that is, such as are sown along with him, and that descend with him, and ascend with him, and that this power which descended upon him, he says, is the seed of the Pleroma, which contains in itself both the Father and the Son, and the unnameable power of Psyche, which is recognized through these and all the aeons. And that seed is the Spirit, which is in him, and spoke in him through the mouth of the Son, the confession of himself as the Son of Man, and of his being one who would manifest the Father, and that when this Spirit came down upon Jesus, he was united with him. And the Savior, who was of the dispensation, he says, destroyed death, whereas he made it known that the Father, Jesus, and he says that Jesus, therefore, in the name of the man, the dispensation, that this has been set forth for the assimilation and the formation of Anthropos, who was about to descend upon him, and that when he received him unto himself, he retained possession of him. And he says that he was the Anthropos, and that he was the Logos, and that he was the Pater, and the Artherius, and the CJ, and the Aletheia, and the Ecclesia, and Zo. And if you can piece your way through all of that, you're seeing, again, a convoluted way of saying that those seeds, the seeds are, of course, the elect who hear the message, they're all the same, and he takes them all up with him, and he brings them all down with him. So he's finding the seed in him finds the seed in the rest of us. Now, that's not something that the church fathers were particularly fond of. Now, Marcus actually had a kind of a magical performance that he did, and this is this business of the mass in which the priestess, he and the priestess shared this communion. I'd like to go ahead and find a little section in here where that's described, if I can find it. But what it basically amounts to is that he and the priestess would get up there in front of the congregation, get up on the by the altar, and Marcus had this small goblet, and he had apparently had a false bottom in the goblet, in which he put concentrated wine, and the priestess would get up there with a glass pitcher, clear glass pitcher, and she'd pour water into this goblet with the false stem on it or whatever, which contained the concentrate, and it would turn into bright red wine. And then if that wasn't a good enough trick, then Marcus would turn around, and he had a great big chalice that he held up, and he would pour that into the big chalice, and then that chalice would then start an everlasting flow. It would start overrunning like it was a eternal fountain. And this, of course, amazed the crowd. And, well, this is all now according to Irenaeus, you know. So you can, people weren't that stupid. I mean, they must have realized that this was stagecraft, if that's what Marcus was doing. But it didn't mean that they were actually performing a miracle. It meant that they were symbolizing this sort of thing. But of course it infuriated the church fathers. They thought it was and Marcus, because he had a following that included at least an equal number, if not more, women, probably had that following because he was being so nice to the women. You know, women like to follow have a religion where they're given as much respect as the men. So he had a number of them, and of course, naturally, that meant that he was going to get accused of whatever. But regardless of that, his philosophy and his tremendous contributions to the Kabbalah are remarkable, and this. His cult, it spread all the way from Tyre and Lebanon and that area, and it spread all the way over to southern France, and it got all the way up into the Rhone River Valley, and You know, I know that sounds kind of weird when you think, and you think about it, and you think, oh, gosh, you know, well, is he up there with those barbarians? And no, I'm going to explain something here that a lot of people don't realize. The first century, second century, and all the way up through the what we call the Dark Ages, southern France was civilized. Yeah, it was civilized. In fact, this is where the King Arthur legends got started back. You think they started in England? They didn't. They started in southern France. Southern France was civilized all through from early Roman times all the way up, you know, all the way up to into the Middle Ages. It didn't really become, southern France didn't become part of the rest of dirty, filthy, life is nasty, brutish, and short Europe until the so-called Albigensian Crusade. And that was in the 1100s, in the High Middle Ages, when the Cathar religion, see, this is, and the reason why I'm mentioning this is because Marcus's cult, which was hermetic, and it's been suggested also by others that it was very Mithraic. Now, I think we all know that the cult of Mithra, at least Western European Mithraism, was really virtually identical with Hermetic philosophy. And the interchange is so much that they're both solar oriented. They're both Kabbalistic. They have the ladder of alchemy and the planets and all the rest of this. All of the things that we associate with Hermetic philosophy are also in Mithraism. So the two are virtually interchangeable. It's been suggested that Marcus was influenced quite a bit by the Mithraites. Constantine, you know, was actually a Mithraite, and he decided to make Christianity the state religion in Rome because he felt that it would Mithraism was too elite, even though they had common people in Mithra sitting right in the lodge with Roman senators and all that. They had common people, but it was elite in your attainments. They didn't take just anybody. You had to be worthwhile or worthy. So Constantine thought that Christianity would be better to keep the slaves under control. And this is why he didn't become a Christian until his deathbed. He decided, well, right before he died, maybe he better become a Christian. Otherwise, what he had accomplished might be discredited. So he wanted to die a Christian, other than that. But in southern France, in that area where Marcus's cult penetrated, this was a civilized area. And so consequently, that cult of Marcus's had an influence. It could have even had an influence on the Grail tradition because of the way Marcus was doing his communion with this ever-flowing cup and the water in the wine and all this. It could have very well. And it, the reason why I said that in the header for this show, that was Marcus the first Rosicrucian? Well, obviously he wasn't, but he was the first Rosicrucian in the spirit of the word, the term. Marcus was every bit. Here we have, way back in the first century, we have a man who combines the Kabbalah, astrology, maybe a little bit of alchemy, certainly a lot of Kabbalah, certainly a lot of astrology, and into his very mystical, very transcendental, and very personalized aspect of Christianity. Now, you can't get any more Rosicrucian than that. I mean, that's almost a template for Rosicrucianism. And so when I say, was Marcus the first Rosicrucian? Well, if he wasn't, he should have been. And the thing about southern France situation is that so much became in the Middle Ages and in the Dark Ages and Middle Ages, so much of what became our Grail legend and our legends of chivalry and all of this, it got started right in that area. That they called, by the way, southern France, that province used to be called Languedoc. And this is where the Parzival, the first of the Grail romances, was written. It was written by Wolfram von Essenbach, who was a German knight. And he was an athlete, but he was also a poet. And he was a professional jouster. And he wrote this Grail romance, the Parzival, but it wasn't Christian. The Grail was a green stone that came down from the stars. And this was virtually a pagan kind of thing. So southern France was an area where Marcus, in his particular mystical version of Christianity, could certainly obtain. Let me read at this point a little bit to you from Kieran Berry, and then I'll read a little bit from the Seventh Ray on Marcus here. Kieran Berry's book, as I say, is anybody who is really interested in this subject. Kieran Berry's book is really excellent. Here we are. The alphabet creates the cosmos. Although much of the meaning of the fragmentary Nag Hammadi Codex we can now be only guessed at, it is clear that both Marcinais and Marcus taught that the letters of the Greek alphabet were connected with the creative powers of the cosmos, and that knowledge of the various combinations of vowels and consonants could bring about control of these powers. The Greek letters are the nomenclature of the gods and the angels, and as they are changed, they submit to the hidden gods by means of bear and pitch and silence and impulse. And this concept was central to so much of Hellenistic magic and can be seen throughout the Greek magical papyri. In the combination of vowels, later permutations, and long lists of barbarous names and voice invoces magici that were obtained in various charms and divine invocations. Hippolytus also gives us an account of the teachings of Marcus and various other Gnostics, drawing most of his material from Arrhenius. And one of these is an Arabian Gnostic named Monoemus, I love that, who made extensive use in his teaching of the letter iota. Now, you remember, and Jesus said that it changed not one jot or tittle in my word. The alphabet, as you, those of you who study astrology, know, the alphabet starts in these days with Aries. But before Aries, before Alexander made the alphabet start at Aries and forced everybody to accept that, the alphabet and the zodiac started with Taurus. Now, Taurus is, it started with Taurus, but it also started with Aleph, which, if you look at Aleph, Phoenician Aleph, it's the sign of the bull. And do an Aleph and turn it with the point down, and you see there's the bull with the horns and the ears and everything, and that was. Now, Moses said, put the Lord God before me. All right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's the bull. That's bull L, of course. And, you know, the bull was the sign of the great god of the Canaanites, the Phoenicians, and which eventually kind of got forcefully transformed into YHVH. But Taurus starts the zodiac and Aleph. And that hangs over into that Aleph, an idea of the zodiac starting with Aleph, and Aleph being the bull, Taurus, that carries over into the age of Aries and we still keep talking about that. Now, one of the books that you need if you really want to understand Marcus, I would recommend the Pistis Sophia, and this is a later Gnostic text that it's close to, it's contemporaneous with Marcus, and that answers a lot of the questions that I'm sure Marcus would have answered, but Irenaeus and Hippolytus didn't answer, and that is the relationship of the earlier zodiac and the letters to the actual signs, the symbolism involved. Now, what I want to do here is you have a idea of what the Soma Sophia is all about. And one of the things that I need to stress before we get into this is that in the Valentinian system, which Marcus followed, there were 30 levels, 30 spheres. And this was kind of unique to this particular type of system. And here we had this circle of the zodiac, which in Marcus's case went all the way around, obviously influenced by the earlier Egyptian Nuit. But this, when you try to kind of unravel Dean Kelly's Enochian tablets, try to figure out where they came from, and this aether system of 30 aethers, it becomes fairly obvious, at least to me, that Dean Kelly were groping for something that I think Marcus had already solved and was lost to posterity and had to be reconstructed. Because the Enochian tablets, with the exception of the fact that they're broken up into all the cardinal signs, the cardinal signs on each side rather than straight around the zodiac, which, by the way, that was a medieval kind of a thing to do that, to split the signs up and group them according to elements. This was a more medieval thing. The ancient Greeks wouldn't have done this, and they would have done it like Marcus did it, all the way around. So if we had the tablets laid out the way Marcus laid it out, we would have something that you could turn right around and apply on the earth, and you could get a direct application. And in those days, the ancient Hermetic astrologers, they actually thought that Egypt reflected the stars above. That's one of the reasons why the pyramids were laid out the way they were, and why the Orion can be traced on the ground, if you believe that. And they had various marks, various points, where you would line up the zodiac positions on the ground, like, for instance, the Great Pyramid or the Omphalos at Delphi, or various places like this, and you line this up, and then you can take and you can apply all the constellations to the ground below, to the earth. And this, of course, as you can imagine, has a great deal of magical significance. And this is what Dee and Kelly were trying to do with their Enochian tablets. They had these governors all laid out. And if you've studied Dee and Kelly's system, you know that they call this terrestrial victory. And they laid these governors out in countries all over the world and tried to apply these Enochian governors to various areas on the ground. And then they even tried to make this archaic. They used Ptolemy's maps to do it, which were outdated by then, but that's what they preferred to do. And then they tried to sell this system to the Polish nobility, the Polish king, as a magical tool. Well, the fellow they got to try to broker this thing for him was Prince Lasky, who I think he was already already almost banished from court, and he was a ne'er-do-well and didn't have anything. So consequently, their scheme never got off the ground, but that is what they intended to do. But they couldn't really do it because they had bifurcated their tablets. Whereas if they'd used Marcus's Summa Sophia fully fleshed out, they probably would have been able to at least accomplish what they were trying to do. Now, with that in mind, I know that there are some people that are probably saying, well, what are we getting in all this Hadouken stuff for? Well, I think it's fascinating to consider where this Hadouken system originally came from and where it was inspired by. And I might mention that me and Kelly did not have Ethiopian Enoch. They didn't. If they even had a copy of Slavonic Enoch, they were lucky. And I don't even think they had that. So consequently, a lot of what they created was coming out of Kelly's head, and not that that invalidates it. It's just that they did not have the biblical Enochian reference. Now let me. Let us go to the seventh ray here, and the blurb says, the Summa Sophia, Body of Wisdom, was the original cosmic Kabbalah of the Gnostic magician Marcus from the second century of the Common Era. Modern scholars now recognize the possibility that this long-lost system of celestial alphanumeric correspondences may have influenced the late Hebrew Kabbalah. It also might be the ancient prototype of Dean Kelly's Enochian Watchtower tablets. Working from the early Christian critic Hippolytus' minimal outline of Marcus's lost system, we've reconstructed the Summa Sophia as a philosophical and practical tool for magicians today. And so I started with this. I said, what if there was a long-lost ancient astronomical chart or manuscript that contained the philosophical and magical key to the formation of the entire universe? An elegant system of alphanumeric attributions that could be extended or reduced in infinite progression to yield precise formulas applicable to any point in the vast reaches of outer space and any place on the earth below. Such a manuscript may have existed in the second century of the Common Era, authored by the Gnostic magician Marcus and ruthlessly suppressed by his Orthodox Christian critics, early church fathers Irenaeus, Hippolytus, and Athenaeus were threatened by Marcus's vision, and were so threatened that Irenaeus wrote, and the latter two recopied, a detailed outline of the basic structure of the Marcosian cosmos for the sole purpose of discrediting it, as in the case of Josephus critiquing the lost book of the Egyptian historian Manetho. We would know nothing of Marcus's remarkable achievement were it not for the overzealous efforts of his detractors. Irenaeus' original account of Marcus's Summa Sophia vision has been recopied, reprinted, and referred to by numerous critics and scholars of Gnosticism for over 1,800 years, and there is nothing secret about it, but there was far more to the system than Irenaeus revealed. It takes a magician to realize this. Irenaeus and his ilk were not magicians, and if they had been, they would probably not have published the key to reconstructing Marcus's system. And before we consider the technical details of this revelation, let us return to the era of its inception and that remarkable magician who was responsible for the Summa Sophia. Marcus was a follower and perhaps a student of the Gnostic teacher Valentinius. This can be deduced from their shared system of 30 aeons. Like his mentor, Valentinius, Marcus professed to be a Christian, but Gnostic Christianity was much different, a different philosophy than the religion of the eventual orthodoxy that St. Paul and the Emperor Constantine would impose upon the Western world. In Marcus's vision of Christianity, Both priest and priestess gave the communion and turned water into wine by magic, which infuriated pious Christians who did not want to be reminded that this was a theatrical special effect, not a blessed miracle. Marcosians viewed the universe as a macrocosmic subject to microcosmic manipulation via the formulas of magic. He was a Pythagorean and a thaumaturgist. He practiced in Asia Minor, having a knowledge of Hebrew and Syriac, but he also had a following in Gaul, in France, and one of Marcus's students, an Egyptian named Harnufus, was a court magician to the Roman emperor and philosopher Marcus Aurelius. With this background and focus, we can better understand the conception of his vision. Now, I think that we should realize that Marcus was not just a Christian mystic, he was also in his own right, a great Pythagorean philosopher. And I say Pythagorean philosopher because this is the whole Pythagorean philosophy involves the mechanics of the cosmos. Plato used this Pythagorean conception in the Timaeus, as we all know. He used it in the Timaeus, and as has been pointed out, Plato was actually a closet Pythagorean. So Marcus is the forgotten man of the origins of both the Greek Kabbalah and the Hebrew Kabbalah. And, of course, if there was a Rosicrucian to be had in those days, he certainly was one. So that's our with Marcus the magician, Marcus the high priest of Gnostic Christianity, Marcus the originator of the Summa Sophia. Next week, we'll take off with another ancient scholar, and we will examine the origins of the mysteries. And until that time, good magic, and take care and be well.